From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has put together an alternative to Obamacare. Ohio's Rob Portman is the first Senate Republican to support same-sex marriage. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is visiting college campuses and the NAACP, speaking out against government surveillance in the drug war. Democrats say Republicans don't stand for anything, just want to tear down President Obama. But these are some of the new faces of the GOP trying to chart a post-Obama path as the midterms and presidential elections draw closer. This hour on Point, can the next generation of Republican leaders be more successful with next-generation voters? You can join us on air or online. What are Republican leaders and thinkers are you interested in hearing from? Do you hear the sounds of a different party? Can any Republican beat Hillary in 2016? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll talk this hour to Ohio Senator Rob Portman and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. But first, joining me from Washington is Republican strategist Antonia Ferrier. She's advised House Speaker John Boehner, former Senate Republican leader Bill Frist, and many other lawmakers. Now she's a senior vice president for the lobbying firm Forbes Tate, whose clients include Comcast, UPS, and Amazon.com. Antonia Ferrier, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John. Good to be with you.
Let me start with a basic question, since I hear over and over from Democrats, including today, as they're emphasizing the issue of equal pay, that Republicans are engaged in a war on women. So why are you a Republican?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, John, because if I were to believe Democrats, that must mean that I'm at war with myself, and I assure you I'm not. The fact of the matter is, John, that women in the Republican Party, we are doing very well. We need to do better, but we are doing very well. We have a lot of bright, shining lights within the Republican Party. And the fact of the matter is that if Democrats were serious about this issue of pay equality, why is it that the first piece of legislation that President Obama signed into law, the Lilly Ledbetter piece of legislation that President Obama promised was going to establish equal pay and stop discrimination of wages in the workforce, why didn't that work? Why are we back here at this, you know, going back to something called paycheck fairness? The fact of the matter is this is not a solution. This is not a solution to the problem at all. And this is just politics. When you get into April of a midterm election year and Democrats are running scared, the president's approval ratings are terrible, Obamacare is wreaking havoc on families across the country.
They just signed up 7 million people.
Well, yes, I'm not sure that's really much comfort to a lot of Americans who are seeing the insurance that they had canceled, that they're seeing their premiums go up, they're seeing their out-of-pocket pay decrease because of it, and because this law is really taking a sledgehammer to the 40-hour work week. I think there's no choice. They have to. It's the law. But the bottom line is that, you know, the president, the economy is doing not as well as the president promised. So when you get back to the war on women, this is a distraction. This isn't real. And it's a very concerted effort by Democrats to try and change the subject. And the fact of the matter is, it's not going to succeed.
Antonia, do you think that Republicans don't even have a problem with women voters or some segments of women voters, or do they? And if so, how would you describe it?
I don't think there's a question that we need to do better. The Republican Party needs to do better. We need to do a better job talking to women. We need to avoid mistakes that have caught us, frankly, flat-footed in the past election cycle and the one before.
Is it communication or policy?
I think it's more communication than anything else because, frankly, you know, I grew up outside the Boston area. And I will tell you that it was Republican and conservative women that attracted me to the Republican Party. It was people like Margaret Thatcher. It was people like Jean Kirkpatrick, who worked for President Reagan. It is, I think, a communication issue. We need to do a better job going and talking to people who Republicans aren't typically comfortable talking to. We need to take up that spirit of Jack Kemp and go into communities and talk to people who are not our typical constituencies. And, you know, frankly, the Democrats, they do a very good job with the soundbite campaign, but that when you look at what their solutions are, they're really not solutions at all. So what I would say to the average independent woman out there, say in Northern Virginia and in the Northeast and on the West Coast, I would say, stop, listen to what we have to say. We have a message that resonates with you. We have an agenda that resonates with you. Just give us a chance to explain ourselves, to talk to you, and I think we can and will succeed when it comes to women and minority voters.
Antonia, stand by. I'm going to bring in our next guest. Joining me from Washington is Republican Senator Rob Portman. He was a House member from Ohio, President Bush's trade representative and budget director before winning his Senate seat in 2010. Yesterday, he was one of six Republicans to join with Democrats on a vote to extend, at least temporarily, unemployment insurance benefits. He was on Mitt Romney's vice presidential shortlist. Last year, he was the first sitting Republican senator to come out for gay marriage. Senator Portman, thanks for joining the show.
John, great to be on with you.
You are helping raise money right now for Republican Senate candidates. You appear to have a very good shot at picking up the six seats that Republicans need to regain control of the Senate, and therefore, if they do it, control of the whole Congress. Do you think that the problems that Republicans began discussing after the 2012 election have been solved? Is the midterm evidence of that, or is it just that it's a different kind of electorate than we see in presidential races?
Well, I think it's a different kind of electorate in an off year. It's also a state-by-state analysis. So we're looking at states where there tend to be more Republican voters because 6 years ago, frankly, was a good year for Democrats, whereas this year is going to be a better year for Republicans. There are seven Democrats serving in the United States Senate now who represent states that Mitt Romney won. In fact, in six of those states, President Obama got less than 42% of the vote. So I will suggest to you that we've got great candidates, and I do think we're going to have a good shot of getting the majority. But honestly,
do you think it's highly likely that you get the majority?
John, I think if the election were tomorrow that we would get the majority. And again, a lot of it runs to the fact that the map is in our favor. The states that are up tend to be more Republican. The math is also in our favor in the sense that there are more Democrats up than Republicans, and only one Republican is up in a blue state. That's Susan Collins, who's doing a great job in the state of Maine and is very popular. So I think it should be a good year for us. The other thing that is happening, though, is the mood of the country has shifted, and this is reflected in the public opinion polls you see regarding the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, but also in the president's approval rating and just the sense of whether people would like to see a Democrat or a Republican representing them. Right now, Republicans are in a good position. There's some momentum on our side. And, you know, my view is that, you know, this is driven by the fact that people are frustrated with the lack of economic growth. They haven't seen the results that were promised by the Democrats. And, again, a lot of frustration with how the Obamacare plan has been rolled out and the increased cost and the lack of choice that they're seeing now. So I think it's going to be a good environment for us, and I think there's a good chance of us getting the majority. What I've focused on, as you know, John, is having a plan for the majority. In other words, to say this is not about beating Democrats. It's about having the ability to go to the American people and talk about why we have a better plan for health care, for dealing with the economic weakness that we see now, dealing with energy and trade and regulations and other issues. Workforce development is something I've worked a lot on. As you know, you mentioned the unemployment insurance issue, and I got involved in that because of my interest in the skills gap and in giving people the tools to access jobs that are out there. So these are all things that we as Republicans need to communicate to folks and let them know that we do have a better plan.
Well, let me ask you one substantive question, and then I'm going to ask you an opinion question. President Obama right now is attempting to negotiate two big trade deals, one with Europe, one with Asian countries. He is proposing a significant expenditure toward closing the skills gap, education and job training. The deficit has come down substantially over the last couple of years. What is your beef specifically with the president's economic policy right now, and what do you have to propose that's better?
Yeah, I think on each of those, John, there's a huge opportunity for America to move forward rather than, you know, in the case of trade, be sitting on the sidelines. President Obama, as you know, is the first president since FDR not to have the ability to negotiate a trade agreement. It's called Trade Promotion Authority now. It's gone by different names over the years, but it's the ability to say to your negotiating partners, let's negotiate an agreement and then take it to Congress for an up or down vote. Without TPA, it's hard to imagine any trade agreement being passed. We've only passed one under that scenario.
But that's an issue where the president agrees with you. He's trying to get it.
Well, he has changed his mind on that, you're right. And about a year ago, and in his recent State of the Union, he did say that he is now for it. Until that time, actually, he was the only president, again, since FDR, not to be for it and not to try to achieve it. But, you know, he has Democrat control here in the Senate, and yet he cannot get it to the floor of the Senate. And so the question is, John, you know, is he promoting it in the way he should be with his own party? If he did that, it would pass the Senate easily. It would also pass the House easily, as you know, because Republicans generally support it.
And what about the other two things? That is the expenditure the president wants to make in education and training. Isn't that pointed in the right direction on the skills gap? And do you not give him credit for the fact that the deficit's come down?
Well, again, I think a great opportunity, as I said, in trade to be able to expand exports that we're not taking advantage of. We haven't been able to do that for, you know, the entire administration. We haven't negotiated any new agreements with regard to the skills gap. Again, a great opportunity for us to take the roughly $15 billion a year that the federal government is spending on worker training, worker retraining. So within, you know, workers who have lost a job to get the skills they need to access new jobs. There, the president has not shown leadership, and I think he can and should, and I think it can be bipartisan. I think you're referring more maybe to his pre-K proposals or other you know, education proposals.
Right.
But there's a great opportunity here to take that $15 billion and use it better. There are 47 different programs spread over seven departments and agencies, and they're not working well. And we'll talk more about the deficit when we come back, but we have, you know, over the last several years seeing the highest deficits in the history of our country, to the point that we've added more debt held by the public than every single president in the history of the country combined.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. In a moment, we'll talk with Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, but right now we're talking to Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who was on Mitt Romney's vice presidential shortlist and was one of six Republicans to vote with the Democrats yesterday to extend unemployment insurance. Senator, I asked you before about whether Republican problems have been solved, and it called to mind a conversation I had recently with Bill McInturff, who I'm sure you know, leading Republican pollster who does our NBC Wall Street Journal poll. And he noted on the call we had the other day that for 6 years in a row, actually scratch that, for 8 years in a row since 2008, yep, the image of the Republican Party nationally has been underwater. Democrats are not popular either, but Republicans are a lot worse. Why is that?
Well, I think part of it is because there has been some infighting within our party. And so I think some Republicans, both on the left part of our party and the right part of our party, maybe are unhappy with the other. And some of that's healthy, you know, competition for ideas and good debate, but some of it I think has been counterproductive. And I think we're doing better in that regard. I look at these Senate races, John, you asked me about earlier. We do seem to have the Republican Party coming together more. And it's around the fiscal and economic issues. It's this issue of debt and deficit we started to talk about a moment ago, but also on how to grow the economy, which is where our party tends to come together and be stronger. So I think we're making progress with regard to that. And then just in general, let's face it, Congress's approval rating is low, and I think both parties are suffering from that. I saw some polling actually in the last few days along the lines you're talking about, and both parties were underwater in the sense of the brand,
yes,
of the parties is bad. But I think among Republicans, we've probably had less unified approach, which leads even Republicans to be, you know, upset with their party, as well as more conservative-leaning independents. And
well, speaking of that infighting, I want to play a clip from Jeb Bush over the weekend discussing illegal immigration. We'll talk about it on the other side. Here's former Governor Bush.
I'm going to say this, and it'll be on tape, and so be it. The way I look at this is someone who comes to our country because they couldn't come legally. They come to our country because their families, you know, a dad who loved their children was worried that their children didn't have food on the table. And they crossed the border because they had no other means to work to be able to provide for their family. Yes, they broke the law, but it's not a felony. It's an act of love. It's an act of commitment to your family.
Now, Senator, as you know, a lot of conservatives attacked Jeb Bush for saying that. Charles Krauthammer, the conservative columnist, said, why is Jeb Bush leading with his chin? What do you make of that and what the Republican Party ought to do on illegal immigration? I note that even though there was a very strong vote in the Senate for a bill last year, you voted against it.
Yeah, I think Jeb's comment reminds me a little of what his older brother said, which is family values don't end at the Rio Grande, which I agree with. And, you know, people are coming here, the vast majority of them, for economic reasons and trying to better their lives and help their families. I think that's true. And I think, you know, that motivation is something that has to be considered in the immigration debate. I also think that we have to have an immigration system that works. So, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. We're proud of that heritage. It's an incredibly important part of the fabric of our country. And I think it's one reason our country has been singularly successful in, you know, growing jobs and creating opportunity. But we're also a country of laws, and we just need to have a fair system that's in place. So I don't think what Jeb said is inconsistent with having smart immigration reform that deals with a broken system. I did not support the Senate bill for a very simple reason, and that's because I don't believe that the enforcement measures in that legislation were adequate or would work. And specifically, I believe at the workforce level, at the workplace, you have to have effective enforcement. I think that is the magnet that draws people, because I do believe people come here, the vast majority of them, to better themselves and to get a job.
Do you think that Jeb Bush can win the Republican nomination if he runs expressing views like that? And do you want the Republican nominee in 2016 to be talking that way about immigration?
Well, yeah, you know, I want the Republican nominee to be talking about a fair system, and that will be, I think, the way people will judge Jeb or anyone else who runs is, you know, okay, what is your policy that comes out of that that approach? I mean, I agree people are coming here with good intentions to help their families and to, you know, help themselves to become economically successful, and that's what has driven, again, so much of our greatness as a country. But the question is, shouldn't there be an immigration system that is fair so people who are waiting in line, say in Mexico, and doing so legally, are not disadvantaged as compared to those who come illegally? We have to have laws in place that make sense. If we don't do something at the workplace to make it more difficult for people to get a job, I do not believe that we will be able to solve this problem. In fact, I don't think people are going to come out of the shadows, John, if they are in a system where they can work without penalty. I know my colleagues on both sides of the aisle who supported this bill may disagree with me on this, but I think if you ask someone to come forward, pay a fine, ask that person to pay back taxes, ask that person to register, to even learn English in some cases, as opposed to simply continuing to work here illegally without any penalty, I think many people continue to work because I don't think all of them are looking for citizenship. Many are looking for just the ability to do exactly what we said earlier, which is to make some money and often to send it home to their family. So I think you need to have an effective workplace enforcement mechanism. There is one. I suggested it. I tried to get it on the Senate floor. I was not able to. I know Paul Ryan and others are interested in that in the House legislation. There was better workplace legislation enacted in one of the committees in the House. And I think that is the key here, is to stop that magnet. Yes, we need to have a secure border for all sorts of reasons, because of drugs and because of guns and because of terrorism and so on. I agree with that. But ultimately, if there is that magnet of the workplace, it will be impossible for us to have an immigration system that works.
Senator, I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Eric on the line from Somerville, Massachusetts. Eric, welcome to the show. What's your question for Senator Portman?
Hi, John.
Hey, Eric.
I got a master's degree 3 years ago, and I still do not have a full-time job. And I only see the Republicans trying to take away health insurance for people with pre-existing conditions and low taxes for rich people, and not helping people like myself have full-time secure jobs so we can have the same opportunities that our parents had. And I want to know what Senator Portman and the rest of these Republicans are going to do to try to help the people in this country instead of talking about the 47%.
Yeah, Senator? Great question, Eric, and I totally agree with you. And look, I gave a talk on the floor last night about this. We have a quiet crisis in this country, and that's people who are out of work. We have, as you know, record numbers of people who are long-term unemployed. That's over 6 months. Both with regard to the recession and even in this recovery. Right now in this recovery, we have more people long-term unemployed than we've ever had in any recession in our nation's history, with the exception of this most recent one. And then we have over 10 million people who have left the workforce altogether. So Eric is still, it sounds like you're looking for a job and you're still counted on those unemployment numbers. But frankly, the 7% unemployment, whatever that number is today, is not accurate because it doesn't count a record number of men. And when you include men and women back to the 1970s, the Jimmy Carter era, which an economy we don't want to replicate, being totally disconnected from work, not even looking for work, much less in the workforce. So we've got some real problems now. And I it sounds like you're sort of blaming Republicans for it. I would say, you know, what the president has done over the last several years has not worked to take the economy out of what admittedly was a very tough situation. This has been the weakest economic recovery on record. We've never had an economic recovery like this.
Did what President Bush did economically work?
Well, part of what happened after the 2001 recession is that he did put in place policies that got the economy moving again. Now, you know, we had the mortgage crisis and we obviously had the financial crisis. But if you look at the so-called jobless recovery, John, after the 2001 recession, remember people talked about that? It turns out at this point after the 2001 election, we had already created millions of new jobs. We haven't created until this last month a single new job. And maybe now we have in the private sector. When you add private and public together, we still haven't created any net new jobs since the recession. That's never happened before. So, you know, you can look at what happened in 2008 and 9, but also, you know, acknowledging that that financial crisis was a very deep recession, but also look at our other recessions, including 2001, going back to 81, 82, which was actually a deeper recession in terms of the unemployment numbers. But by this time, we'd created 7 or 8 million new jobs. We aren't doing that now. So to Eric, I would say two things. One, let's look at ways to actually create economic growth generally. You know, John Kennedy used to say famously, a rising tide lifts all boats. We need to do that. And that's where we have this jobs plan where I laid out earlier, dealing with issues like tax reform and trade, as we talked about, expanding exports, dealing with this skills gap in a much more aggressive way to reform the current program to make it work better. And then let's also deal with the specific issue that Eric mentions. In other words, dealing with health care in a way that doesn't have this big increase in cost but does provide for people with pre-existing conditions. The high-risk pools, in my view, are something we ought to have as part of a health care solution. But it can be done, and it can be done, you know, through providing incentives and through providing subsidies at the state level. There'll be a federal involvement here in terms of subsidizing it. And let's do something to provide more access to health care. My own view is we ought to give people who are not in employees health care plans, so they aren't working for a company that provides health care, the same sort of tax benefits so that they could have a tax credit to go out and buy health care. I think you then would find there'd be more transparency, more competition, more choice, and you're going to see a better healthcare system at the end. In this current environment we're living in now, one, we have obviously a lot of frustration with how to deal with the Affordable Care Act, how to get coverage, but also higher costs.
Senator, choice. I don't want to cut you off, but I want to keep my word your staff because I know you've got another appointment. So I want to thank you for joining us. We will look forward to seeing how your jobs plan fares over the coming months.
Great. Thanks for having me on, John. Good to talk to you as always.
You bet. Well, joining us now from Baton Rouge is Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. Last week, he unveiled his alternative to Obamacare. He's also joined with former Governor Bush, who we heard from a few minutes ago, to promote newrepublican.org, a super PAC. Governor Bobby Jindal, welcome to the show.
John, thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor to be on the air with you.
Governor, I want to start with a question that I also ask Senator Portman, and that is, Bill McInturff, the Republican pollster who polls for NBC and the Wall Street Journal, told me the other day that for 8 consecutive years, the image of the Republican Party has been underwater. Why do you think that is, and what's the solution for it?
John, well, I think the Republican Party needs to be the party of growth. We can no longer be the party of no, the party of austerity. I've disagreed with a lot of the president's policies, but we cannot just be the anti-Obama party. I think we've got to go out there and say we are all for policies that help folks join the middle class. We're not the party of big business. We're not the party of special interest. That's part of the idea behind that New Republican group. But for example, I think there are things we could do today that would help people get good paying jobs. In Louisiana, we've got an unemployment rate that's only 4.5%, and there are things we're doing to bring manufacturing, good paying manufacturing jobs back into our state. I think we could be doing that across the country with an energy policy. You're right, I did unveil a health care policy last week that helps folks with pre-existing conditions, but also brings down health care costs. I think there are things we could be doing in terms of EPA overregulation, encourage more job creation. I think there could be things we could be doing with tax cuts and tax simplification that take away the special breaks for the special interest. As a party, we've got to stop being the party that's just opposed to things. We've got to present alternative solutions. One great opportunity for us is education reform. I'm a big supporter of charter schools, school choice, of tenure reforms, so that every child gets a great education. These are the kinds of policies I think that are attractive to folks, that actually solve problems that people worry about. Instead of us always just being opposed to things, let's go out there and be for things. I think as we do that, we'll earn the right to be the majority party. John, right now, right, there are a bunch of folks in D.C. that are telling the Republican Party, hey, just run against Obamacare. Don't offer solutions. That way they can't criticize you. I think that's a mistake. I think we've got to be for things. I think our country faces a huge challenge right now in terms of creating good-paying jobs. Let's go show folks that conservative ideas work and can create those good-paying jobs.
Governor, I want to get you to one of our callers. Chester is on the line from Worcester, Mass. Chester, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. This question was more for the senator, but it'll work for the governor, too. As far as I can see, since John Boehner announced that the main goal of the Republican Party was to make Obama a one-term president, they've opposed every single initiative that the president has made to help the economy. And then they're blaming the economy, the economic problems, on the Democrats, when in fact it's 100%, as far as I can see, a Republican problem. And I don't think the Republicans, other than by repeating over and over again the same untruths, will be able to convince the American people otherwise in the short run or in the long run, because the alternative solutions that I hear proposed are the same exact solutions that I've heard proposed for years. And they didn't work in the Bush administration. They're not going to work. And that's about what I've got to say. Thank you.
Chester, thanks for your call. Governor?
Chester, I do want to thank him for the call. Look, I think there's a lot of frustration, rightfully, with everybody in Washington. I think the only place you can see conservative principles being applied right now are in Republican-led states. There's a reason that governors, Republican-led states with Republican governors, have unemployment rates that are lower than those in the rest of the country in Democratic-led states.
Is it important, Governor, for the next Republican presidential nominee that it be a governor? And that's not a trick question.
No, but look, I'll be honest. I would prefer a governor. I said that last time. I think governors have executive branch experience. I think they've had to balance their budgets, that cut taxes at the state level. Republican governors have taken on pension reform and education reform. They've held the line on not increasing taxes, cutting government spending, creating private sector jobs. They've done education reform, school choice. They've done a lot of things. When you look at some of the most successful governors, for the Republicans, I think we would claim, we look at Ronald Reagan, obviously. I think Democrats would look at Bill Clinton. Those are both presidents that had been governors before. One of the criticisms we make of President Obama is he had never run anything before he was president. He'd never been governor, never run a company. So I think there is a practical benefit to having governors run for national office.
Governor, I want to quickly, before our break, get a response from Antonia Ferrier, who is now the sole representative of Washington on this show. Antonia, do you agree with Governor Jindal that all those Washington politicians in your party are lame and that the Republicans need to look outside for a governor?
Well, I don't think they're lame, but I do absolutely understand the frustration that your caller, Eric, expressed. There is a lot of gridlock in Washington. Frankly, I hate to play the partisan game, but unfortunately right now we have a president and Senate controlled by Democrats, and they're not very interested in working with us. But generally speaking, I think a lot of great ideas come from the state. So for that, I completely laud Governor Jindal for what he said.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, who unveiled his Obamacare alternative last week. He's joined with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush to promote newrepublican.org. Governor Jindal, Chris Christie has gotten a public battering over the last few months, but he appears not to have abandoned his idea of running for president in 2016. I want to play a clip from him talking with ABC's Diane Sawyer a few days ago.
I am who I am. And for some people, they love it. And I will tell you, when I travel around New Jersey, I hear from most people that that's the thing they love the most.
And what about Iowa?
Oh, well, I think they love me in Iowa, too, Diane. I've been there a lot. I think they love me there, too.
Governor Jindal, do they love you in Iowa, and are you running?
Look, I'm certainly, it's something I'm thinking about, and I'll make that decision after the 2014 elections. But, John, one of the things I think we need to do right now is win the war of ideas. Prime Minister Thatcher said you've got to win the debate before you win the election. I think our middle class is struggling right now. President Obama tells them your wages aren't going up, health care is more expensive, tuition debt is rising for your kids. Don't worry, the government's going to take care of it. And they know that doesn't work, but they don't see an alternative. As conservatives, we need to show the American people what we can do to create good-paying jobs. That's why we unveiled our health care plan last week. You know, the president likes to say there's no alternative. That's simply not true.
Let me ask you about that health care plan, because some of the health care policy experts on the Democratic side, at least, the liberal side, looked at your plan and said it's really not much of anything at all, in the sense that it would raise some money by taxing health benefits, which is something that would, of course, be attacked as a tax increase. It's setting aside $100 billion to help states provide health care, but across all 50 states, $100 billion isn't very much. And you would kick all those people off of the Obamacare exchanges and the Medicaid expansion that the president has done, and that's not really going to get us anywhere. Leave alone the fact that it's going to be extremely difficult anytime soon to repeal Obamacare.
Well, I wish they'd actually read the plan. I know those are great Democratic talking points. If they actually look, it's a 16-point plan. According to independent analysis of similar ideas, or some of these ideas, it would actually decrease premiums from where we are today by $5,000 for an average family. It would decrease individual premiums 5 to 8%. It would guarantee cover with those with pre-existing conditions. It would actually encourage wellness and investment in health savings accounts and in wellness accounts. It would actually reform and save Medicare beneficiaries 6% of out-of-pocket costs, hundreds of dollars a year in Medigap premiums. It would help Medicaid actually improve health care. It would actually help folks buy insurance, break up the cartel so they could buy insurance across state lines through voluntary cross-state purchasing pools. It would also allow people, it would equalize, would not increase taxes, it would cut taxes.
Are you assuming with your plan that this is something that could only happen with the new president and Republican control of Congress, because it's not possible to get the job done politically unless that happens?
No, I think we need to fight every day to repeal Obamacare. I think it's bad policy. The president himself in 08, John, said the right things. He said, and I'll quote, "I believe the problem is folks aren't trying to avoid getting health care. The problem is they can't afford it." He opposed the mandate when Senator Clinton proposed it. I think he was right in his rhetoric. Unfortunately, his bill, his plan, doesn't reduce health care costs. Premiums actually go up. According to independent analysis, health care spending actually goes up, not down. And I think we need to remind him, let's do what he said. You know, his rhetoric in 08 was very good, very conservative. I think that nobody's arguing we need to go back to the status quo of what health care was before Obamacare. We need to improve it. The way to improve it is to allow individual patients to own their health care, get the bureaucrats out of the way. So it's not the government bureaucrats or the insurance bureaucrats telling them how to get health care. Get Washington out of the way. Don't force people to lose health care they wanted. Instead, let's empower patients, but let's make it more affordable. The number one problem in health care was it wasn't affordable.
I know our time with you is short, but I got one of your constituents on the line. Reginald's calling from Port City, Kentucky, but he's from Louisiana. Reginald, you're on the line. What's your question for Governor Jindal?
I have more statements. That man there has never been for anything public. Over 8,000 people lost their public jobs. Anything that he has done has been for business. And as far as the thing with him helping Louisiana, he spent more time out of Louisiana than he do in Louisiana. He's been running for president since he's been in office.
Reginald, thanks for your call. Governor, what do you have to say to your constituent?
Reginald is right that we've cut 28,000 state government jobs. We had the largest income tax cut in our state's history, cut the state budget 26%, but here's what that's helped produce. We have more people working in Louisiana than ever before. Our economy has grown 50% faster than the national economy, per capita income the highest than it's been in 80 years. John, after 25 years of people leaving the state to out-migration, for 6 years in a row since I've been governor, more people have moved into the state than moved out. We've got over $80,000 new jobs, $50 billion in private capital investment coming into the state. To your earlier callers looking for jobs, look to Louisiana. Our private sector economy has never been stronger. More people working now than ever before at a higher income, more people living in our state. So Reginald's right. We have held the line on government spending. We've done the opposite of what they've done in D.C., and the results are For the first time in a generation, our children and grandchildren are beginning to move back to Louisiana. Our economy is outperforming. Our unemployment rate was now the lowest in the in our region the last time they released these data. A couple of months ago, the largest drop in the country. Our unemployment has been below the national average every month I've been governor. So Reginald's right. We've held the line on government spending and government jobs, but we've created private sector jobs. I wish the president would do this. You know, if he approved the Keystone Pipeline, he could create $5 billion of private sector investment in our country without federal borrowing, without federal spending, could create tens of thousands of good-paying jobs, construction jobs. That's what we need in D.C. We're doing it in Louisiana. Other Republican governors are doing it in Florida, South Carolina. They're doing it in Michigan. They're doing it in Texas, a bunch of states across the country. That's the kind of leadership we need in D.C.
Governor, we've got to keep our word to your staff, too. I know you've got other appointments to go to. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
John, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, we're joined again by Antonia Ferrier. She's a Republican strategist in Washington. And, Antonia, I want to play a clip from another new rising figure in your party in Washington and get your reaction to the on the other side. This is Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, in an interview with Glenn Beck on The Blaze.
If I go to a crowd of 1,000 people at a university and say, your taxes are too high and your regulations are too high and we should balance the budget, they're like, that doesn't affect me. But if I tell them, you know what, the government shouldn't be looking at your cell phone. The government shouldn't be looking at what you read unless they have a warrant. You have a right to privacy. Young people will wake up and they will listen to this. There are many people who are open among all these disaffected groups who really aren't steadfastly supporters of Obama or an ideology. I think they're open to listening.
Antonia, I want to ask you if you agree with Senator Paul, but add one element to it. He is also, as a libertarian, like his father, an exponent of the view that the United States should do less overseas. Some critics call it an isolationist kind of view. Is that the right way for your party to go? Is that a winning message in a national election?
I think that's actually been a dialogue within the Republican Party for a very long time. You've had the sort of more isolationist libertarian camp when it comes to foreign affairs, and then you've had more expansive camp, sort of the more of the Reagan camp. And Reagan himself was actually, back in the 70s, not quite as expansionist in terms of global engagement.
Which camp are you in?
I would be more in the Reagan camp. I am more of a traditional Republican. I'm more of a defense hawk myself. But look, I think that it's really important to understand why Senator Paul's voice resonates so well. He is talking to young people about issues that they care about. He is reaching out, talking to them about things. While I may or may not agree with him 100% on a lot of issues, the fact of the matter is Senator Paul has a lot of courage. He goes out and talks to people, goes to campuses, talks to young people. This is something I was talking about at the beginning of the show. With Jack Kemp, he would go and talk to people who did not necessarily share his views, and he would go with a positive message and talk to folks and say why conservative ideas would help them address their needs and move America forward. So, you know, Senator Paul, he is doing something that is not within the traditional Republican Party's comfort zone, going to youth voters and talking to them and saying, we have ideas for you. And frankly, the Republican Party does need to do a much better job on that front. 2008, I mean, you saw Barack Obama, historic president, landslide election, who really generated so much enthusiasm among young voters. And, you know, it's very difficult to replicate given who Barack Obama is, but we have to do a much better job. So for Senator Paul, my hat goes off to him. He generates, he and his father generate a very vocal group of supporters across the country. And that's something that every Republican should be envious of and proud to see Senator Paul doing.
So we're talking about the Republican challenge in winning over young voters. We've got Carl on the line from Amherst, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the show.
Hi, John. Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'd like to ask about the Republican plan for mitigation of climate change. I realize I'm probably about part of the 20% or so that feels this issue very personally, but I look at my nephew and my friend's children, and I worry about the crop losses that the IPCC predicts of 10% per decade, and ocean acidification, and what that's doing to our fish stocks. And I'm worried about like my nephew and my nephew's children being able to find food in the 50 years or so that it's going to take before the environment comes into equilibrium with the carbon emissions we've got now. To me, this is a conservative issue. It's a family issue. So I'd like to know what the Republicans have to say about this.
Carl, thanks for your call. And Antonia, isn't this an issue of modernization for the party such that, you know, young voters take it as a given, I think, that climate change is happening, just as they take as a given that same-sex marriage ought to be legal? How do Republicans appeal to those people if so many in the party reject the notions that Carl was just articulating?
Well, I appreciate Carl's call, and there have been Republicans who have spoken out very publicly about doing things on the question of climate change, Senator McCain, Senator Graham just being two of them. And in fact, there have been a wide group of Republicans who have tried to address environmental issues. But I think that, you know, for Carl in Amherst, Massachusetts, you know, it's the question of environmentalism. It tends to be a cultural value. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate the conviction he brings to what he was saying. I think that, you know, when I've talked to some of my Democrat friends, my Democratic family, what I typically argue to them is this, that when it comes to those issues, you need to empower people to have those kind of cultural values by moving them up the economic ladder. When you have families, working families across the country, whether they be in Massachusetts, Ohio, or Texas, or wherever, these are people who are struggling to put food on their table, get their kids off to school, making sure they have books that they can read, all of those questions. These are the bread and butter issues they're worried about. So we need to first empower people to have better paying jobs, better quality of life, so they have the ability to care about things as a top burner, top line issue for them, like climate change, like those environmental issues. But for most families, when you're living in a recession, and I would say we're officially out of a recession, but this economic downturn, most Americans that are struggling out there, Senator Portman laid out how dire our economic situation is right now. We need to get people back to work. We need to give people good paying jobs, and then they afford the luxury to be able to confront those kind of issues.
Now, Antonia, I want to switch gears for a moment and talk about the choice of issue that Republicans face. Remember, they've got very big long-term problems as they think about 2016. But Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, has got a right now idea, and I want to play a clip of what he told John Carl of ABC a few days ago.
It is the most unpopular law in the country. Millions of people have lost their jobs, have lost their health care, have been forced into part-time work, have their premiums skyrocketing. And right now, Washington isn't listening to those people. That's how we win elections. That's also how we repeal Obamacare.
So, Antonia, you've got problems with unmarried women, with Hispanics, with young voters. Is Ted Cruz right, and that this horse, Obamacare, is what you guys need to ride all the way through the end of the year?
I think it's a very important part of what we ride, but it has to be more than just that. And I think Senator Portman and Governor Jindal really articulated why we need to be and continue to be the party of ideas. And so, yes, look, Obamacare is an albatross around the neck of Democrats.
Isn't it getting lighter all the time, though, when they have the enrollment numbers that were higher than expected, and when you have people who become invested, and hospitals become invested, and doctors become invested, and drug companies become invested in the system? Doesn't that make it harder as you get down the line to rip that out and disrupt all those arrangements?
Well, I think let's look at New Hampshire. It's just north of Massachusetts. It only has one insurance carrier.
Bobby Jindal's looking at it.
Well, there you go. In the state of New Hampshire, Obamacare has been an absolute disaster. It has resulted in fewer choices, higher premiums. You have people, I think there's only about less than 10 hospitals that will take the one Obamacare-approved insurance plan. That is putting people in New Hampshire they're experiencing a worse healthcare situation than pre-Obamacare. That's unacceptable. And frankly, as you just mentioned, New Hampshire is very important in terms of the primary process for both sides. Oregon, there is state after state where people are looking at their premiums, are looking at their healthcare choices, and for them, put aside hospitals and insurance companies and everything else, they are seeing that they are having to pay more. And one point that I in particular want to talk about from what Governor Jindal said, the president promised that healthcare costs would go down. what Obamacare does, it does nothing in terms of cost containment. And that, if the American people want to see an improvement in their paychecks, we are going to have to deal with the cost of health care, which this law does nothing to do.
Antonio, we talked a little bit about 2016, and before I let you go, I do want to get your view on this question. I don't think any of your former bosses are running, so you're not conflicted. Who do you want to be the Republican nominee, and who do you think has got a shot to beat Hillary Clinton if she's the Democratic candidate?
Well, I would just say I hope that Democratic voters don't like their party figures assuming that Hillary Clinton will necessarily be their nominee. I know Republican voters don't like that. I don't have a horse right now. I think there are a lot of great candidates. You had two people on that today that are fantastic.
A lot of mainstream Republicans say they were for Chris Christie. Now he's damaged. And now they want Jeb Bush. Are you in that camp?
I think there are a whole host of people who are out there. I think we're going to have to see how they fare going forward. I don't have a horse right now, but I think we've got a lot of excellent candidates, a lot better than most people are saying, and I think we're going to have a very strong chance in 2016 to take
that. There you see that Antonia Ferrier is a politician, too. Antonia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, Ukraine's hot, the Mideast is a mess. Is the White House realigning foreign policy or frittering away its powers? I'm John Harwood for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.